Time now for hour number two in our two-hour get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here now is the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Kelly Sullivan Walden. She's a best-selling author, certified clinical hypnotherapist, and the founder of Dream Life Coach Training. She's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled, It's All in Your Dreams, published by Canary Press.
Now, I was surprised to learn, Kelly, that your interest in dreams started when you were a curious five-year-old. So tell us about that.
Yeah. I had a phenomenon take place with me that normally happens with twins. I have four sisters, and my sister, Shannon, who's closest in age to me, we shared a bedroom. I shared a bedroom with a couple of other sisters on and off throughout my growing up years, but Shannon was always kind of the one that I was closest to, and often we would do what's called tandem dreaming on accident. We would share a similar dreamscape or a similar dream theme or even a similar dream. So because that happened often enough, she and I both became really interested in dreams, and on a daily basis we would go out of our way to remember them and share them with one another, and we found it a great source of nothing really more than entertainment, so we thought at the time. But I think it helped to, we were kind of like psychic kids in a way. We would play with psychic phenomenon and things like that, but mostly dreams were, because we didn't have the Xboxes that they have today and any of the high-tech gadgets, we had to use our imagination to keep ourselves entertained, and we did. So that was how it started. Then I became a hypnotherapist as an adult about 17 years ago when I started seeing clients and working with their subconscious mind. So then I began working with dreams professionally, but that background as a kid definitely came in handy.
I would say so. Yeah. So now let's get to the intriguing subject, our dreams. Mm-hmm. In layman's terms, what are they?
At the very basic level, our dreams are helping us to survive better. On one level, if we didn't dream, we would not last very long. It's believed that we sleep in order to dream, because during our dreams, we even when I'm not talking about the dreams that we remember, so many of our dreams are helping us to process the events of the day, helping us to organize our thoughts, helping us to become better prepared for what's going on with us. If we were back in caveman days, we'd be learning how to run from big scary dinosaurs, or we'd be learning how to scavenge food. In more modern days, we're learning how to process emails and the things that we could say in an email, for example. I mean, it's just helping us to process things so that we become a better version of ourselves each day. Now, on the highest level, our dreams help us to heal. Our dreams help us to actually explore a larger aspect of ourselves. We could say there's the little self, and there's the big self. Our ordinary waking life, we're our little self, where we think we're just our body and our body of affairs. In our dreams, we get to explore our big self, the part of us that is truly unlimited. We can commune with departed loved ones. We can commune with masters. We can learn new languages. We can explore phenomena that normally we would have no right to know anything about. And it's literally endless, the things that we can explore in our dreams.
Let's talk briefly about the three biggest misconceptions about dreams. So what are they?
The first, I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions. But the ones that I hear most often are the following. Some people believe that they don't dream, and that's false, because it's believed that everybody, and this is a Harvard study, many sleep studies prove that we all dream between 3 to 9 big dreams a night. We dream all night long, from the moment we close our eyes to the moment we open our eyes. So there's different types of dreaming, but there's 3 to 9 big dreams every night. So when somebody says, I don't dream, what they really are saying is, I don't remember my dreams. The second misconception is that dreams don't matter. And if we look at the list of the inventions that have come directly through dreams, the invention of insulin, for example, the invention of the sewing needle. We wouldn't, I'm sure all of your listeners, it's in some way, shape, or form, unless they live in a nudist colony, are wearing clothing. The sewing needle came to us in a dream. Albert Einstein attributed his theory of relativity to a dream that he had as a young boy. Even our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, attribute the language that was in the Declaration of Independence to dreams. The first and largest oil discovery came to Colonel Harold Dickinson in a dream. So many things. And then there's movies, the Twilight series and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and great movies, great, the song Yesterday from Paul McCartney came through dreams. So if we say dreams don't matter, it's a misconception, because so many of the elements of art and history and medicine that really define who we are and keep us alive have come directly through dreams. And then the third misconception, one of the most primary misconceptions, is that some dreams are bad. I believe that even the most terrifying nightmares and even the strangest dreams that don't seem to make any sense at all of them come in service of health and healing. So even the bad dreams, I always tell people there's no bad dreams. We might have nightmares, they might be scary, but even those dreams, if we work with them, can give us a tremendous insight about what we're working with and how to heal and how to become a tremendously better version of ourselves.
Well, I like what you have to say about dealing with nightmares. Face a nightmare, race a nightmare, and then replace it. Now, here's what I really, really want to know, because oftentimes we don't remember our dreams.
Yes.
So can you give us a few quick tips on how we can do that?
Yes. The first thing is that you, after listening to this, hopefully your listeners will say, well, then I want to remember dreams. You need to at least have the desire to remember your dreams, because it's inconvenient. When we wake up in the morning, all we want to do is get a cup of coffee and get to our emails or do whatever our morning routine is. If it's not our routine to pay attention to our dreams, then it takes a degree of will and it takes a degree of focus. But so first you have to get the sense that there's value in dreams. So that's number one. Number two is you want to have something to record your dreams with, and you want to have it right next to your bed. You want to have either a dream journal, or in my case, I have my iPhone, and I have a dream recording app on my iPhone called Dreams Cloud. It's a free app. There's many of them that you can get out there. I particularly like this one. And there's a lot of free ones. So you want to have it nearby so that it's easy to record when you wake up in the morning. You want to set a declaration before you go to sleep. Just like the founding fathers, I mentioned them earlier, they didn't create they created the Declaration of Independence, not the intention for independence or the hope for independence. That was the declaration, and thus a new world was created. So if you set a declaration before you go to sleep, I will remember my dreams, then most likely you will. So then the critical part is when you're laying in bed, and you're about to wake up in the morning, you start to notice the sun on your eyes and you start to become aware that it's time to wake up, or you hear your alarm. In that moment, what most people do is they bolt out of bed and they break that fine tissue between, that connective tissue between dreams and awake. What you want to do is stay in your sleep position, turn off your alarm, but come back into your sleep position and stay there for a little bit and ask yourself, what was I just dreaming about? If you stay there for a few moments and recall at least the most recent dream that you had, then it's like you're fishing and you've connected with one little part of the fish and then you'll be able to pull it up. And within a 3-minute period of time, if you write your dream down or share it with somebody, then you will have effectively caught a dream.
One of the things that I learned from your book that was so helpful was why my dreams sometimes are so bizarre, and I never thought about it. But you write, you know, our brain centers that control logic and rational thinking are asleep.
Yes.
And that's why we just see our thoughts and feelings.
Yes, yes. To me, that was so helpful to hear that, because I've heard from so many people, there's so many different rationales for why our dreams are so strange, but the scientist that I met last year Robert, he said that when we go to sleep, our whole brain doesn't go to sleep. It's just the part of our brain centers that controls our logic, our reasoning, our ego, our rational thought. That part needs to go to sleep because it's been on overdrive all day. So while it's asleep, our what's called our association cortex and our limbic brain is awake, especially during our REM cycles. That's our rapid eye movement cycles that happen every 40 minutes or so. And when those centers in the brain become particularly stimulated, and those, especially at the association cortex, it speaks in symbols. And it's our visual cortex. We don't see with our eyes, but it's the same function. That's why our dreams are so highly visual. We actually see in our dreams what we're feeling and what it means to us. So when we see, like for example, I had a dream a couple nights ago about strawberry wine, which is so strange because I've never seen such a thing. And I was carrying a glass of strawberry wine and a whole bunch of chocolates in my hands, and I was trying to run from one place to another. And somebody said, "Why are you running?" And I said, "Because I'm on a book tour and I can't miss any appointments." And all of a sudden I tripped over something and I spilled my strawberry wine. And I was so sad. And I woke up in the morning, I said, "Okay, what does strawberry wine mean to me?" And I didn't really have a clear picture because I've never seen strawberry wine in my life. But I thought, well, strawberries I love. They're so sweet. So it feels like something very sweet. And then the chocolate feels like a dessert. And it feels like something great. And like, for example, doing interviews like I'm doing with you, Carol, it's like chocolate to me. It's delicious. And in my attempt to do every interview, I feel like I've been trying to juggle too many chocolates and the strawberry wine, such sweetness that in some ways maybe I've become a little manic. So my dreams were telling me, Kelly, make
slow
sure
down.
You sleep, slow down. You can't do everything. Some things you're going to have to put off, but you can't put off your interview with Carol.
Oh, and I'm so
make
glad.
Make sure you
put
that one
I'm
in.
So glad.
But the other ones you can say no to. So
and
my dreams were being helpful to me, and they were helping me to look at things symbolically, and it gave me a tremendous insight, so I've been able to slow down a little bit.
That's Kelly Sullivan Walden in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled It's All in Your Dreams, published by Canary Press. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with J.R. Lankford. She's the author of the Jesus Thief series, which hypothesizes the famed Shroud of Turin is authentic, published by Great Reads Books.
How in the world did you come up with a unique idea? And, of course, I want you to tell our listeners who haven't read your series what the unique idea was, but how did you come up with it for your series of novels, starting with The Jesus Thief?
Well, one day, my husband and I are both electrical engineers, and we love to follow all the new developments in science. And so I was, I think we were watching a documentary, and at any rate, one day I learned there really is type AB male blood on the Shroud of Turin. I'm sure your listeners know it's that cloth the Vatican owns that has the image of a man on front and back, an apparently crucified man. And many believe it's the burial cloth of Jesus. Well, I hadn't thought about it one way or the other until I learned this. Because that blood type is rare in the U.S. and in Europe, but very common in Jerusalem. So that piqued my interest. And then when I found out that a scientist, a real scientist, had actually run PCR replication on that blood, it just blew my mind. So I had the title for the first book, The Jesus Thief, in my mind immediately, and the plot. And it begins with a scientist. My scientist is named Felix Rossi. He lives in New York. He's a very wealthy man, has two Harvard degrees, but his passion all his life has been the Shroud of Turin. So there he is in Turin, and his dream is about to come true. He's assembled a scientific team, and he gets a call from his sister in New York, And from letters she's discovered, they learn that their parents were really Jews who escaped Nazi Italy. So here he is in a religious turmoil that many people have actually experienced. And that causes him to snip bloody threads from the shroud, smuggle them back into New York, and try to clone Jesus of Nazareth. So that is the theme of the entire series, what happens after that.
And it is such a fascinating premise. Now, in 2003, you had written your thriller, and you sent a copy of it to animal cloning pioneer Dr. Robert H. Foote of Cornell. So what did he say about what you wrote about cloning?
Well, he and I, in fact, had a long correspondence after that. I'm proud to say he called the novel a spellbinder. He said the cloning science in it was accurate, you know, up to what we knew today, you know, where science was at that time. And the thing is that I set out to do that. I tried to write the novel in such a way. Of course, it's a thriller, so it's not a science book. But even so, as the story unfolds, I tried to write it in such a way that when a reader closes the book, he or she knows what cloning is and all the issues, the medical issues, the ethical issues, the religious objections. You know all of that by the time you finish The Jesus Thief. Because I knew and he knew, we discussed it, that this would actually happen one day. Well, we have had a major breakthrough just last month. It was announced, and in fact it's in the June 5 issue of the journal of the called Cell. It's the journal, scientific journal, that there has been a major breakthrough in the science that could result in human cloning. And for the first time, as far as we know, it's possible. And I'm proud to say they got a 50% success rate in producing clone pre-embryos, just like my fictional scientist did. So that made me kind of happy as an author.
And hopefully they're going to use that for some medical purposes.
Well, that's what this was done by scientists at Oregon Health and Science University. They, of course, are not interested in human cloning. They are trying to advance the science, stem cell research, which is tremendously promising, simply because it offers the ability to produce stem cells. Stem cells can turn into any kind of cell in the body, heart cells, bone cells, brain cells. Stem cells that are genetically identical to you or me, for instance, whoever needs them, and introduce them into the body to help cure diseases that we haven't yet found a way to cure. So it's tremendously promising medically. However, from my viewpoint, in terms of my novels, the same process that this process can produce either stem cells for medical treatment, or it can go on and produce an egg, artificially fertilized egg, that can be implanted in a woman's womb and result in a cloned child. So the trouble is that all the work in this area isn't being conducted in officially recognized scientific labs. Private efforts at cloning have been going on all along, and there was such a ruckus about them here in the U.S. that the people who were doing it, as far as we know, went offshore. One's operating in France, another is operating in Lebanon. And I promise you, the results that were just published are those private labs, the ones we know about and the ones we don't, are absolutely busily at work with those results, trying to advance their cloning efforts.
If human cloning does become possible, do you think society will embrace it? And what should the restrictions be on cloning? Would we want to clone geniuses like Einstein?
Well, exactly. That was one of my concerns, and it was part of why I wrote the book. I was just amazed at the possibilities. The trouble is, we're not going to be able to prevent it. All we can do, because once we have crossed this break, what the scientists succeeded in doing is called nuclear transfer, and that was the big challenge. So it's done. And according to the reports, this is real. It's been accomplished. And the rest of the procedure is very much like in vitro fertilization. So we're not going to be able to prevent this from happening. Because if they, one country won't allow it, another, they'll go to the country that will. And even if we criminalize it, that's the best you can do, it's still not going to prevent it, you know, unless the whole world all of a sudden gets up, passes a law, criminalizes it, and then you could sort of control it. So it's something we're going to have to deal with, one way or another. And that's why I wrote the Jesus Thief as I did. It ends with the birth. And all the rest of it is dealing with the problems, with the challenges, with the morality of doing this, because we will be able to clone the living and the dead. There are efforts underway right now to do just that.
Wow, it's all I can say.
Yeah.
And I want to get back for a moment to the shroud of Jesus and what a scientist saying now about this 2,000-year-old shroud and the genetic material that was found on it.
Well, that is one of the great fascinating scientific mysteries of our time, because originally some people said that the shroud was a fake. It was from, you know, the oldest record we have of it is from 1300 something. And they said it was just one of the many other religious fakes made at that time. Well, the problem is, if it was, we ought to be able to easily prove that. Because in the 1300s, to my knowledge and to anyone else's knowledge, the technology to produce what we actually see on the shroud didn't exist. At any rate, there have been all kinds of tests done on the shroud material by a great number of scientists. And so just last month, a group of Italian scientists at the University of Padua just said, listen, the shroud isn't a fake. Now, no one will ever be able to prove that it is, for instance, the burial cloth of Jesus. You can't do that. We need somebody, a relative of Jesus, you know, to compare the DNA on the shroud to that person. So that's never going to happen. But it's amazing that this relic exists and that it can't be proven a fake.
That's J.R. Lankford in conversation with Carol Marks. And if you'd like more information, go to jrlankford.com. A Touch of Gray continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do. And I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined the rest of the way with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now will be interviewing Janice Ian, the iconic pop star known for many, many decades. She was recently inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. She's been inducted into that wonderful institution on two separate occasions. And in 2013, she won the Grammy for Best Spoken Word Album. Janice's autobiography, Society's Child, took home the award, and that, of course, was her big hit tune. Now, Richard, before we play this interview, which I know, as they say in radio, it's already in the can. You did this a few days ago, and none of us here have heard it. You've heard it, obviously, because you did it. You will try to recall, and we'll talk about it on the other side of the interview, the time that you and I met Janice Ian. It was a very, very high-flying experience. Do you remember it at all?
Now that you say a high-flying experience, there was a concert in Randall's Island in New York, right?
Yes, remember?
And Janice Ian, see, now I don't remember Janice Ian being a part of that at all. But, you know, the funny thing is, I've interviewed her a number of times and met her a number of times.
And you forgot that.
And you kind of say, well, yeah, you remember that, don't you, Janice? And it's like, well, no.
Yeah, well, I mean, come on. You know, when you meet somebody who's well-known and you're meeting them for the first time, you remember it. When somebody like that meets people from radio or does a million interviews or whatever, it... that they had not heard of, perhaps, or was not as popular as them. I'm trying to be polite about this.
Yeah, well...
it's not as big a deal. Listen, we have to hear the interview, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back on the other side, and we'll talk about the time that we took Janice Ian for a joyride. Yep, that's coming up next, ladies and gentlemen. When A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and now, as promised, here's Richard Neer in conversation with Grammy-winning recording artist Janice Ian.
And we're joined by Janice Ian now. She won a Grammy this year for Best Spoken Word Album, and she was up against the likes of Bill Clinton and Michelle Obama and Rachel Maddow, so that's a pretty large honor, and I imagine it was a bit humbling to be in that kind of company, Janice.
Humbling and scary, Richard, all at the same time. I really didn't think I stood a chance.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You grew up in New Jersey, as did I spend a lot of formative years in New Jersey. And everybody expects people from Jersey to talk like they're on the Jersey Shore. And you have this beautiful speaking voice as well as your singing voice, beautiful articulation.
Oh, thank you.
What made you...
My mother didn't allow accents.
Well, it's interesting,
yeah,
because
you
touch on...
Really limit us.
You touch on a lot of that in your autobiography about how your parents, although they were not wealthy, were very into culture and music, and they really exposed you to a lot of art that a lot of families that are not financially well off may not have done.
That's true. They believed very firmly as first-generation Americans that their children could be anything they wanted to be, and they really worked hard to make sure that we had whatever opportunities they could find. Now, we didn't have much money. My father was a farmer, a chicken farmer, and my mother was a waitress. My father went to school on the GI Bill, and he became a teacher, but it was all very much hard work. So we were raised with the, I guess, American ethic of you work hard, you get somewhere. You don't work hard, you don't get anywhere.
Now, you also, and this is really a switch to the way it normally works, because normally the parents are religious and the child goes off and becomes an agnostic, atheist, whatever, and rebels against the religion. In your case, it was exactly the opposite, wasn't it?
Yes, I went the opposite way, and my parents were both atheists, and my brother and I both wound up believing in God, so it's pretty funny. But I think in my life in particular, I always try to remind myself that things happen for a reason, and that if you are on the right path, and you're congruent with that path, things work out for the best. Like the audiobook of my autobiography, I wanted to do an audiobook 4 years ago, and 4 years ago, we didn't really have the technology to do it the way that we wound up doing it. 4 years ago, I wouldn't have been nominated for a Grammy. 4 years ago, it wouldn't be selling so well, and it would have been too expensive for most people. So even though it was depressing to me at the time, it worked out very well.
Now, talk about the technology and what changed that allowed you to be able to do this.
Well, a lot of it was the rise of downloading and the rise of people, the consumer, understanding how downloading worked. So that we have Kindles, we have Nooks, we have iPads, we have computers now. 4 years ago even, much less 10 years ago, people didn't really understand that you could download something and you could then make a CD of it for your car or put it into your iPod. People understand that now, so that's reduced costs dramatically, which meant that I could go to audible.com and say, you know what, I would like to do a book and I would like to do the music in the book as I'm narrating. And then I would like you to put it out for under $20. And for Audible to run whatever information they ran and statistics they ran and say, okay, we'll try the experiment with you. We're willing to lose money initially on this and see whether it doesn't make a difference and bring more people toward audiobooks. And it worked.
Now, is the process similar to going into a recording studio and making an album? And if not, what are the differences?
Well, when you go in to make an album, when I've gone in anyway, you usually go into a large room with other musicians. You've got an engineer in a separate room and a producer, usually. And there's the recording process and all the preparation that goes into it, writing the charts so everyone knows the chords, working out the arrangements with the musicians, and then when you're done mixing the whole thing, putting it together so that it sounds okay. And you don't have more guitar than voice, let's say, and then sending it in to be mastered. It's a long, involved process. With an audiobook, usually you're in a room the size of a small closet, and it's just you and a microphone, and on the other side of the door or glass is an engineer, usually, who is also a director. You record it straight through, and then it goes to editing, where they take out the uhs and the ums, if they're in there, and then you're done. So in a lot of ways, it's a much simpler process. In a lot of ways, it's a lot scarier, because you don't have the backdrop of the music and the musicians.
Did you get direction as you did it? Did you get, wait a minute, stop, maybe you should do it this way, or was it pretty much you as an artist interpreting it the way you wanted to?
It was pretty much that, but I had a really good director, Stefan Rudnicki, and Stefan knows enough to stay out of your way when it's going well. I had to learn a few things, like the tendency is to speed up when you're nervous, and I had to learn that it's the same when you're reading as when you're on stage. You have to slow down, forcefully slow yourself down, and remember that the person listening is not going to be able to listen that fast.
Now, would you consider doing audiobooks of other people's works, or is this something that you would only do of yours? Okay, tell us about it.
I'm about to do four more. So, and that's going to be really interesting because they're other people's words and other people's thoughts, and I don't have the luxury of already knowing the story. Of course, I've read the books and I've read the scripts, but it's not the same as living them.
Are they all autobiographies?
No. There's one that is an autobiography of Miriam Teresa Winter, who is the foremost feminist theologian in the world today. There's music involved in that. There's one called Patience and Sarah, which is a seminal, oh, I hate to say this this way, but a lesbian love story that came out in the late 60s that was the first gay book that many of us read where everybody didn't die a horrible death at the end. There's a Stars anthology, which is actually 24 stories by authors who like my work in the science fiction field who wrote stories based on my work. And then there's a book called The Tiny Mouse that's got a record accompanying it that comes out in September about a little mouse that runs away to sea. So there's a pretty wide gap there.
Now, as you know, in your autobiography, you're basically speaking with your own voice, but in these novels and these dramatizations, there are other characters. How are you going to approach that? Are you going to use different voices? Are you going to use it in your voice with different accents or inflections? How do you do that?
Not too much, because that's not really what I do. There's people like Catherine Kelgan, who does the Bloody Jack novels, who can do 40, 50, 60 different dialects. I can't do that, and fortunately nothing that I'm doing is going to really require that.
Now, as you continue this, is this something that you will continue to do with your musical career? Will you go back and forth? Do you have kind of a chart for how you plan to go forward?
No plan, no. I'm coming off a 10-week 45-city tour, so I'm not planning to go back on the road for a while. But
it's interesting, in your autobiography you talked about sort of being pigeonholed in the beginning. People wanted you to be, or everybody was like Joan Baez. They had long hair, they were long and slender, and they sang
right.
Folk music and all that, kumbaya. And you were different. And when did you reach a point, and you obviously did it very early because you were a success very early in life, carve out that niche that I'm Janice Ian, I'm not Baez, I'm not Judy Collins, I'm not any of these other female singers?
I think that's something that you just come to as you continue writing and performing and find your own voice. Certainly, I started out imitating other people, like most of us do. I did a pretty good Odetta imitation, and then I did a pretty good Joan Baez imitation, until somebody said to me, you know, they're doing a pretty good job of being themselves, and you're never going to be as good at it as they are. And I realized that I really needed to be myself. But it takes years to learn to be yourself. As a performer or a writer or any, you know, a radio personality, too. I mean, it's the same thing.
Well, having been an FM disc jockey for over 30 years, and me growing up, I remember listening before I actually got a job of you, and you were an FM pioneer because you did Society's Child. And I remember listening to an interview with you, and I think it was Murray the K, and also Scott Muni down the road. And this was something you never heard on the radio. You never heard an artist do a song and talk about the song and be interviewed on a music show. There was a long segment of you talking about it, and that was really pretty groundbreaking in FM underground radio, or what became progressive radio.
Well, honestly, I didn't have anything to do with that. That would have been Murray. He was the program director at NEW at that point, and he was a very brilliant guy.
Well, but I think also the song really kind of broke ground, and obviously you know that. I mean, it was a controversial song. Did you get a lot of people ripping you for that song and the message that it sang, that it was an interracial love affair and, you know, just accept it? Did you have problems with that?
People were very angry over Society's Child. It was the height of the civil rights movement, so a lot of people took offense and got very mad at me. But, you know, it was a good song. It is a good song, and it was a necessary song. And I was so pleased that Murray and people like him dared to play it, because that was really daring.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't the kind of thing you heard on AM Top 40 radio in those days. Finally,
at that point, no.
Doing your autobiography, I know in writing my book about FM radio, I learned a lot of stuff about myself. I'm wondering, doing your autobiography, some of the insights you had, some of the things that you thought about that maybe you hadn't thought about in many years.
I think the main thing that I learned was that a lot of the things I thought were very important when they were happening turned out not to be very important in the scope of an entire lifetime. And that was good. It gave me some perspective.
That's Janice Ian in conversation with Richard Neer on A Touch of Gray. Touch of Gray continues in just a moment.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison here with you in the anchor chair, and we continue our conversation now as we come to the final segment of this big two-hour get-together with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, excellent conversation with Janice Ian. And we were talking earlier before we played that interview that it was a concert back at one of those islands in the middle
Randall's Island.
Randall's Island, which is located in the middle of the
East River.
The East River, where the East River is still quite large. Actually, the East River is not a river. It's the Long Island Sound, where it gets narrow and looks like a river when it comes to New York.
And it runs into the Harlem River.
Right, right, right. And creates Manhattan and as an island and the whole thing. You and I were MCs at this event. We were both disc jockeys at the late, great WNEW-FM in New York. And often DJs would serve as MCs at big concerts. And you and I have done a number of them. And we went to LaGuardia Airport, where we were taken in a helicopter to get us into Randall's Island. And there were two other tag-alongs who were performing at that event on the helicopter with us. One of them was Janice Ian, and she was pretty well known at that time because Society's Child was kind of iconic. This was circa 1971.
This was before Jesse and at 17, which was her later hits.
Right, right. And there was another iconic pop star from the 60s who was on that little ride with us. It only took about 10 minutes. Do you remember who it was?
I want to say Buzzy Linhart, but
nope.
I don't know.
Nope. I wouldn't.
Richie Havens.
I wouldn't bring Buzzy Linhart up because I would think most of the people listening to this program do not remember Buzzy Linhart. He was a huge star in New York at that time, and a very talented
guy. He wrote "You've Got to Have Friends," which was a big hit for Bette Midler.
Ah, okay, that's his claim to fame. So, but he was a great star in his own right. And there were so many of them from that time. But the star that we rode with was a star who had a very, very, well, two very big hit singles earlier in the 60s. They were two pop singles, and he never achieved that success again. He tried for many years, but he had two real hot rock and roll singles in the 60s before the era that we were DJs at WNEW-FM. And
I have no idea who you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, I'll give you a hint. Part of his shtick was the city that he came from. And his backup band used the name of that city in their name.
Hmm.
Okay.
Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band? Was it the Boss?
No. One of the words in the backup band was wheels.
Oh, 10-wheel drive?
No! The city was Detroit.
Mitch Ryder
yes.
in the Detroit Wheels?
Mitch
Ryder
Mitch
was on that helicopter?
Ryder. You were obviously concentrating on speaking with Janice Ian, and you didn't notice that Mitch Ryder was sitting right next to you on that ride.
Well, the truth be told, I was so fascinated that the first and maybe the last time I'd ever been in a helicopter. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was a show on TV in the 50s called Whirly Birds.
Oh, I remember that well.
And it was about a couple of guys that had helicopters.
Yeah, they were police.
They were like forest rangers or something,
yes,
right?
Yes, they were forest police, and they went in little helicopters. I loved that show. Next week, I want to talk to you about helicopters and moi. I was very lucky that day that we went to Randall's Island in the helicopter that I didn't get seasick. Because I took it for granted that I'm capable of riding in helicopters, and the next time I rode in a helicopter, which was a couple of decades later, they had to turn around and bring me back fast so that I
would. Well, that was on that commando raid that you were on.
yeah, right. Richard, super job. Thank you for joining us. Richard Neer, our senior correspondent. Thank you, Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line, putting it all together. Carol Marks, we applaud you for the excellent work that you do as the host and founder of this program. Thanks to Steve Wiseman, Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, your friendly anchor, inviting you to join us next weekend for another big 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.